This Restorative Justice Life is a production of Amplify RJ. Follow us on all social media platforms at Amplify RJ, sign up for our email list, and check out our website at amplifyrj.com to stay up to date on everything we have going on. Make sure you're subscribed to this feed on whatever platform you're listening on right now so you don't miss an episode. And finally, we'd love it if you left us a rating and review. It really helps us literally amplify this work. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the episode. Welcome to This Restorative Justice Life, the podcast that explores how the philosophy, practices, and values of restorative justice apply to our everyday lives. I'm your host, David Ryan Barcega Castro Harris, all five names for the ancestors, and I'm the founder of Amplify RJ. On this podcast, I talk with RJ practitioners, circle keepers, and others doing this work about how this way of being has impacted their lives. I know I say this often, but I'm really excited about today's episode. Not only is our guest an amazing human living this restorative justice life, they're also the first guest here that I didn't know before the interview. I first learned of Richard Garcia when I heard him talking about the restorative justice work he's doing with Alma Backyard Farms on an episode of This Filipino American Life. You know, the other podcast that inspired this one's title. Because this was our first time meeting, we chatted for a while before we hit the record button. We do our best to give context where it's needed in the recording, but there may be some things we mentioned that didn't get recorded. We cover a lot, from his roots in restorative justice, working with incarcerated youth, to the restorative work he's doing with the farm now. We also talk a lot about the idea of interconnection, which brings me to the special announcement. In this episode, I mentioned the term kapwa, which is a Filipino word that expresses the idea of the interconnectedness between all beings. We also mentioned terms like Ubuntu, Inlakech, and Metakuyasan. This isn't the first time these words have been mentioned on this podcast, because for me, our ancestral values of interconnection are at the core of restorative justice work. My wonderfully talented friend, Crystal Chavez, and I collaborated to create a design that incorporates these and other ancestral words for interconnection into the roots of a tree. Since this is an audio medium, I can't fully describe how cool it looks, so check the link in the show notes to see for yourself, and while you're there, grab a shirt, hoodie, sticker, or mug with the design to remind yourself of these values and share them with your community. I've kept you waiting long enough. I'm super excited for the connection I made with Richard, and I can't wait to share our conversation. A quick note, we switched recording methods during the second half of the episode, and he was also recording this episode from the farm, so don't be too surprised when you hear his voice change and when you hear all the city and farm noises that you'd expect to hear at an urban farm. Make sure you're subscribed to this feed so you don't miss an episode, leave a rating, review, and share with a friend. Enjoy our conversation with Richard. Welcome, Richard. Who are you?
Richard Deogracias Garcia, my full name.
Who are you?
I am Filipino American.
Who are you?
A Los Angeles native.
Who are you?
I am my parents' only son of Benedicto Garcia and Simplicia Garcia, and brother of Jennifer Garcia.
Who are you?
Currently, I serve in a capacity as executive director, co-founder of Alma Backyard Farms.
Who are you?
I'm a believer in God. I'm a believer in God, a follower of Jesus, and reliant on the Holy Spirit for some answers, if not more answers, or all answers, really.
And finally, who are you?
I'm a person who prefers the tougher path as opposed to the easy one. Yeah.
Yeah. I love doing this exercise because, you know, the first couple are easy, right? And like getting deeper into who people are is, you know, where I hope we can get to in this conversation. But, you know, it's always good to check in at the beginning of conversations. So with the fullness of this question, and you can answer it to whatever degree you want, how are you?
How am I? You're not going to ask me the seven times, are you?
No.
All right. I could be seven different ways. I'm hoping to finish the year strong. You know, the fatigue of the COVID-19 fatigue. I think generally speaking, though, I mean, that's compounding the fatigue that people feel at this time of the year. you know, when I worked as a pastoral minister inside juvenile halls and facilitated some retreats in prison, there would be this sense that folks doing time would feel the particular angst associated with the holidays. And so I think I have kind of an awareness of that, and maybe I, in one way or another, share in that spirit where I could feel the, you know, there's added pressure. We used to joke around, but I think it is a reality that divorce rates are higher during the holidays. But I think there is just the sort of angst or stresses associated with that. So I am hoping to finish strong. You know, we have three more grocery kit giveaways where we provide fresh food, grocery staples, and other prepared foods for community members facing food insecurity. We want to do that and finish it off strong. And then there's still the seasonal shift. So, like, you know, we only experience warm and cool. So, like, we're pushing plants that are still summer plants. I want to see how long they could go. Like okra and like tomatoes, we're still growing that. So it's, you know, I'm in the grind, hoping to end the year strong.
For sure. Yeah, there's a lot that you've got going on, and you've been doing this work with Alma since 2013, right? And before that, you know, this term, like restorative justice, has been a part of popular lexicon. I'm curious how you feel, where you feel like your entry point into the work of restorative justice was.
I wrote, this is probably more the academic side. I know you said that, you know, restorative justice may have very well been a part of my life prior to the explicit recognition that I'm partaking in some restorative work. But I think there is roots in my own Christian Catholic upbringing, and I know it's not a Catholic thing per se, but I completed a master's degree in pastoral theology at Loyola Marymount University. So there's probably a similar wavelength with regards to our academic background. And my thesis was on reviving the sacrament of reconciliation by looking at it in terms of restorative justice and vice versa. And so, to just give you a brief snapshot, the beauty of restorative justice and what it puts up front is we are all stakeholders in one another's well-being, that somehow, some way, we're connected. And so I think interdependence is a word associated with restorative justice. So in the context of reconciliation, just confession is known as an individual act, or at least popularly known as one, where it's between the confessor, an ordained priest, and the person confessing, and God in this mix. But we forget that the harm, equivalent to the sin, is done within a context of community, and you've definitely harmed another person. But I think with the practice of reconciliation, it's not made explicit enough that there's a communal dimension to the work of forgiveness, to the work of restoration. I think where I fit in, if I could even squeeze into the conversation of restorative justice, it would be with kind of a broader brushstroke, really creating fertile ground for the conversation between the person or persons who have wreaked havoc or caused the harm and the persons who've been harmed. If you look at it from like a legal document, right, it's the state of California versus said individual, right? Because there's been a breaking the law, right, versus the state. And so what restorative justice offers is, it really is a paradigm shift of how can we heal where punishment may be part of the process, but somehow, some way, and I don't know, this is kind of off the cuff. It's like, kind of like there's a lot of polarization, right? And so I think too often it's either one or the other. It's extreme punishment or nothing at all, right? And there's this big disparity. And I think my experience of restorative justice, it brings some balance, and maybe harmony is more the word in terms of how you approach healing harm.
If I may, I think about a quote unquote classic definition of restorative justice, thinking about, you know, the questions that a traditional punitive legal system asks is like, what rule was broken, right? Not who was harmed, but what rule was broken, who did it, and how can we punish them? And with the restorative approach, you're talking about, you know, what happened, who was impacted and how, not just the people involved, but everybody else in the community who supports those people and who those people support. And then how can we make this right? Right. It's not just about like, this is the punishment. It's, you know, what can we do in order to heal, bring people back together, and make people whole? You're talking about, you know, on one end, there's like a punitive end of the spectrum. On the other end, like there's this permissive, oh, just like let it happen or ignore the problem. But with restorative justice, you know, we're doing things not to people. We're not doing things for people. We're doing things with people alongside them, giving them the support that they need in order to move forward together in a good way, to be, again, like you were saying, this idea of interconnection, be contributing members of our community.
Yeah, I think you know, the principles of restorative justice, even in light of what's happening in the world with COVID-19, I think I had read something where we're at a point where we have to help each other survive this before we think about thriving again. But before we approach the question of how, again, do we interact and live with each other and work towards thriving, I think I'd read something where it was about rebuilding better. And there may be some real takeaways besides a damn vaccine, right? And I'm not denying the severity of the pandemic, but there's a lot more sicknesses and illnesses and harms that we have to attend to. And okay, circling back to what you had just said about restorative justice, and the legal system that says, hey, we've broken this rule, this law, and this is the punishment attached or that parallels this, the severity of this. You know, what restorative justice does is it opens a space for dialogue where we could ask this question, is how the heck did we end up here in the first place? And that may shed light on the understanding. It doesn't excuse the act. But I think in order to really impact healing, we have to ask ourselves, how the hell did we get here? And I think restorative justice allows for us to explore that. So the healing is not just for that act itself. It's for deep-rooted pain. That's what's so key about restorative justice. It makes room in the conversation to ask ourselves, like how did we end up here? And maybe if that question is posed, we can start coming up with some answers of how not to. And that's the real... So like restorative justice, it digs deep, really deep. And I think that's what makes it maybe in some way particularly difficult. Because I do think there is resistance to restorative justice. You know, when we hear how it's done and said, it requires that, okay, if in the traditional sense, right? How I understand it traditionally is, you know, you have the victim, the offender, and then you have the reconciliation that may take place as a result of, right, that meeting. But if we're looking at things so methodically through like that legal lens, it may reduce the room or eliminate altogether the space to ask those deeper questions. And so what happens, and this is what I've seen, it's a larger framework on how to approach something. What I've seen happen is it's blasphemous to the realness of restorative justice, where people give up on it so fast, where, oh, it's too soft, it doesn't really work. I mean, I've come across that sort of attitude or disposition, And I think it requires a real hard look when people are attempting to practice it. There's a lot of a reflective element. You got to check yourself when you're either in a talking circle. I'm ranting right now a lot, right? But I think it's like honestly, I feel you on the other end listening. I think that's another thing that restorative justice does. It compels people to know how key it is to not just listen, but to feel listened to. So that's, you know, I mean, I'm just ranting, dude.
Yeah, no worries. You talked about how, you know, you first learned the term restorative justice academically, and there's some background within your Catholic upbringing around this idea of restoration and reconciliation. How did you like really start to embrace that for yourself? Because it's one thing to write a paper about something, right? But how did you start to embrace that in your own life?
And I'm saying this as a believer and as one who's been particularly impacted by the Jesuit way. And I think along my experience of pastoral work, living with Jesuits and discerning a vocation, prior to that, I was at Loyola High School, and I you might have heard this over at with my conversation on this Philippine American life, but it was my contact with Father Greg Boyle, founder executive director of Homeboy Industries, when he presided over Mass. And just fast forward as a believer, I live with the conviction that if you look at human history, and God's revelation in it, it's moments of light in the darkness, and where God's revealed God's self, it's been in filthy places like a manger or a stable or a tomb that's open. So like as a believer, following the direction of where God puts God's self, and if that's revealed through the person of Jesus, it really is in ugly spaces. And how am I tying this back to your question? It's about downward mobility and where God makes God's self known. Your question was about how did I first embrace the term?
Yeah. And so like if I was to follow it up right now and say like how did that value system show up in your life, and how does that manifest now?
So as a believer following the direction of God, it's to go to those places where there's darkness, maybe we could bring about some light. Where there's despair, maybe some hope. Where there's harm, maybe some healing. And so it's following that direction, living with that reality, it's like, I guess it made itself known with the term restorative justice when I was drawn to work with youngsters in the juvenile system and folks who were doing a stretch in prison. And so that's where it became more explicit to me. I did attend a conference in Fresno. I think Howard Zerr was a speaker. I don't know if is it the Mennonites?
Yeah, he's a Mennonite.
Yeah, so there's a university up there. I attended I think it was a 3-day conference. And so there was a lot of discussion on this, and I think that helped to shed light and give words to what may be taking place. Like, for instance, if you were at Loyola in Chicago, you may have come across like the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius or the contemplative practices, right?
So I wasn't that deeply ingrained into the spiritual life there, but I am familiar. I think to give folks context who weren't privy to like the conversation that we were having before we started recording, we connected because I had heard you on this Filipino American Life podcast, which is also the inspiration for the title of this podcast. This is sort of Justice Life, where you were talking about, you know, your work, and my friend Mike, shout out if he's listening, recommended that we talk. And you know, having a background, going to Loyola, getting a master's in social justice, in line with like my restorative justice in the restorative justice work that I was trying to do, is like, oh, I can really connect with Richard on this. But yeah, I at Loyola, it was more about, you know, going there to get like the letters MA behind my name, so like, you know, you get to be taken more seriously in the world. I think a lot of what I learned about restorative justice was more in community, from the people, like you were saying, like going to the places where, you know, people are in need the most. I think one of those places is Precious Blood Ministry of Reconciliation, which is in the Back of the Yards neighborhood. We had Pamela Purdy on this podcast. You talked a little bit about their work. But I think one of the things that is on the door of Precious Blood, and I don't remember who this quote is attributed to, but like, if you've come here to help me, you're wasting your time. But if you're here because like your liberation is tied up in mine, then we can work together, right? And so it's not just about going to like save people, right? It's understanding that we are connected and working together with people who are marginalized, oppressed by these systems, right? Is how we all get free.
That's it there. We're I mean, I say it to our crew and our staff, like my well-being is wholly dependent on yours in a way. And to be, you know, completely honest with regards to like the classical experience of it, I haven't done a whole lot of that. That's been very, most of my work has been done with persons incarcerated in the system. I think if anything I could be contributing to also, it's, you know, we say this about our work because we work with food, right? So, I mean, it's a play on words. It's like making the conversation about reentry and restoration. We want to make it palatable so people could feast on that. It may turn some people off. So, like, in regards to the sort of healing that I've experienced, you know, in the places that are dark and despairing, and by no means do I want to give you the impression like we're trying to do something heroic. I think our approach is really accompaniment. We really accompany people. We walk together. The sort of healing that I've witnessed, because the healing's a process, is what's very explicit is at the front line of our grocery kit giveaway are folks who've been previously incarcerated. So they're part of their return home and their healing, and them, you know, healing communities through food where they help to grow it and distribute it and harvest it, share it. And so, I mean, there's some restoration in a grocery bag. I think that's how we're doing it right now.
Yeah, for sure. And I think like the point of this podcast is to show folks that like it doesn't have to be like this fancy formal thing, right? The fact that you are just showing up and being with people and providing for basic needs and helping them be contributing members to like this community, right? With things as simple as food, is that restorative work. So when you have people who have served life sentences or have been incarcerated for long periods of time, doing this work in the farms, growing food, and then being on the front line, sharing that back with community, that's restorative in itself. I'm curious how you got from, you know, writing academically about restorative justice and studying to be a Jesuit to this place where Alma is now.
I think like you, I was trying to just get the two letters. Not entirely, but you know, it's like, you know, I don't know, somebody explained it to me. It's like a credit card, right? And you need more credit.
Exactly.
I guess, you know, it could put you in the hole too. I think Alma Backyard Farms is a culmination of my personal and professional experiences growing up, wanting to find meaningful, purposeful interactions. Some of my background includes having worked at Homeboy Industries, Jesuit Restorative Justice Initiative that facilitated retreats inside prison. But I think what along the way, you know, I think in my own practice of listening to people, even collectively, I think it is true that folks who've done their time want to give back. They want to get back and give back. And there are more, you know, forgiving people on the other end who want folks to return home and have a home to return to. I think there's that piece of the more communal dimension of restoration, where, you know, it's this whole act. So how did I get to this? It was, I think, you know, I had a few moments where I was blessed to witness how edifying urban agriculture was for folks who've been locked up a long time. Normally, I'd be into like delayed gratification. I think there's good discipline in that, I guess. But there is immediate gratification when you could see things grow. I mean, there's a time period, but there is the immediate gratification of knowing that you did something. And I think part of the restoration of folks who've been incarcerated is to give them the opportunity to do something, to amplify that and let it translate into concrete, real concrete, something really concrete, whether it be food or a raised bed or that sort of thing. So that's, but it was experiences that kind of led me to say like, okay, Alma is a place where we should dedicate ourselves full time.
Yeah. So you went from seminary, right, to working within prisons with the Jesuits and within Homeboy Industries. Are there a couple of experiences in there that really stand out to you about, you know, this work is important and needed?
I usually reference Sarah's story because when I was at Homeboy Industries, we were mini farming. And I think she laid it out best. We were leaving the cafe, going into a farm plot that at one point in her life was what she considered enemy territory. And so the last time she drove down that block was when there was real potential that she would partake in a drive-by. So I noticed her kind of spooked that we were driving down the street. And she shared that with me. The last time she was there, they were likely to engage in a drive-by shooting. And this new moment of her being there was that she was going to plant life in what was considered territory hostile to her. I think that story of someone having the opportunity to plant life where they were trying to take it away helped me to see that it was worth putting more of myself into this endeavor. That's one. And then, you know, oftentimes you'll hear people say, I don't know how to give back what I took away. I don't know how to do that.
Yeah.
There was one moment here in Compton when we had just finished completing one portion of the farm. And the field we're on now for the longest time was abandoned. It was really just a place with, you know, shoulder high weeds, a bunch of gopher holes, really unkept. And so you could still see it from, it's still visible, but no one really paid attention to it. When we were completing a portion of the landscape, Adolfo, he ended up sharing this with us, that when he had seen how excited the kids were, the school children were, they got to take a sneak peek at the landscape, the deck, the farm. He ended up sharing with us that was probably really the first time he felt that he returned home. So I think there's moments of restoration like that are very quiet and moving. Those are a couple stories. There's a few others that are pretty poignant. I mean, there a lot of them tend to be kind of hopeful.
For example.
So one example is it's a concrete jungle here, and it's, if there, let me let that noise pass.
Sure.
We're getting river rock dumped here because we're finishing some parts of the farm that require some retention. So there's a flatbell that's tilting. Could you hear it or no?
Yeah, I can hear it. But this is an audio medium, right? So for those that don't see what I see, it looks like you're sitting in front of a freezer, right?
Yeah, it's a refrigerator.
In the middle of a farm, right?
Yeah, so behind me are bananas, and this is an an ode to our Filipino ancestors. My dad somehow managed to get a banana here from the Philippines, and one of them's also from my.
They always find a way.
They find a way, man. See, we're naturally restorative. We'll find a way. We'll find a way to make this work. Yeah, my ninang Vicky, who passed away a few years ago, she gave me the apple banana. They're the little small ones. They have a little bit of a tangy taste, but they're very sweet. You know, I can't make turon. Are you familiar with some Filipino foods?
Yeah.
I can't cook it, man. But I could eat it.
That's what stores are for. Or aunties.
That's what they're for. Or, you know, like my dad, he's a cook. He's the one that cooks in the household. Yeah, sorry about that. Okay, they're done.
So, you were talking about hopeful stories.
Yeah, so I think, you know, someone once described Erica, who works, and we wouldn't be here without her. She's co-founder of Alma Backyard Farms, but someone once told us that we're a little willful, like, well, will it into its existence if we have to? And I think in certain cases you have to. I don't see what's wrong with that. But I was telling you how this place was, you know, abandoned, full of weeds and all of that. And I think, I don't remember his name, but he also runs a local garden. The remark he had was that we've proven that this is possible. I think if, you know, we dream of ideal spaces, and one day you're going to have to come out here to see the transformation of land. It's a visual cue that change can take place. Mm-hmm. And it's even more of a visual cue when you see who's helping do it. So I've always thought of urban agriculture as maybe it's like the physical address of restoration in a way. Because when we started this, I noticed that it, you know, the land was a place where it's almost disarming. You know, if we were to introduce folks who've been previously incarcerated and even explore what might be on their record, there's all this angst that accompanies having to interact with that person. That's how you're introduced to them. But the way people are introduced here at the farm is you're introduced as an urban farmer, a grower, and so it's very disarming, mm-hmm. because you take genuine interest in the person growing your food. Like, who's, you know, how are you doing this? And there's a skill set behind that. So I think the space itself creates, you know, I think a sense of hope. A lot of longtime community members on this particular block haven't seen, you know, like a lush space. That's something also.
Yeah. How does someone, how do you recruit people to come to work with Alma?
Through our partners who have partners like the Anti-Recidivism Coalition, like Homeboy Industries, like the Jesuit Restorative Justice Initiative, through the households that house folks who've been incarcerated by word of mouth. I think, you know, the best approach to helping anyone get established after a long term in prison, I think is through community, even the community network of organizations, nonprofit, for profit, whoever it is. It's you know, they say it takes a village to raise someone, right? And in a way, when you're reentering, you may have aged, but you have to grow again. You're having to set roots again, you know. So partner agencies. When we started off here, it was through the parish, where the pastor then was like, hey, there are these youngsters. Could you do something with them? So it's a number of ways.
Yeah, definitely. And what is is it a program that people go through, or do you bring people on and they work there as long as they want to?
So we have three core programs, and I'm kind of giving you the pre-pandemic three core programs because everything was in person.
Sure.
We have our urban agriculture training program where we work with up to 100 people per year who've been previously incarcerated. They go through a 6-week program where they're introduced to everything from horticulture to carpentry to irrigation and plumbing, how to grow food and even the distribution side of where it goes and how to sell it. And that's our first. Our second is our programming with youth, where we reconnect them to the land and to the food they eat, and help them and encourage them to become mindful, even as they discern how to dispose of waste, whether it's compostable or recyclable. And then we have our third, our farm stand, which is like our social enterprise, our social venture, where we were offering in person, this is in person to folks at the farm, the food we grow and some other local items like locally baked bread, prepared foods like smoothies. That was offered monthly. Now we've actually scaled up because of COVID. It's curbside pickup. So like there's been a pivot, right?
Right.
The urban ag training program, with our current crew, we haven't taken anyone new and we haven't resumed in-person training. But because we've had to intensify our growing, our current crew has been brought up to speed with more advanced techniques of how to grow, good agricultural practices, proper handling, food storage, and its distribution. So that's a little bit of a pivot that's kept that alive. Our programming with youth, we've done a few things to make it go virtual, where we've teamed up with others in the field of youth education, where we've done, we'll soon have like a cooking demonstration, composting lessons online. But we do have the kids weekly now. I don't know if you could hear them. They were excited to plant peas. So they're over on my... They're doing PE now on the field. That's our youth program now. That's our pivot. But the largest pivot has been creating access to fresh and nutritious food during this time, where we distribute 500 grocery kits monthly. That's meant we've had to, you know, be on point with our growing so that we could have repeated harvests. We also finished building out a farm site in San Pedro. It's about a 1/4 acre. So we have more land to farm, and I'm hoping that we could figure out how to rebuild better so that we can create the teams to farm and to create a team to do the farm stand. So I anticipate that there will be an inevitable bounce back. I think that's inevitable. When that'll happen, it may be happening now. It's just how we're shifting the way we think. Maybe that's part of how we're going to have to do this. But I anticipate we'll have a solid farm stand where fresh, nutritious food will be made available at a very affordable, very affordable. And if not, it's pay what you can. Right now, everything we've done has been distributed for free. And that's thanks to a lot of generous supporters. We've been met with a lot of kindness along the way. I know there's a lot of negative stuff that's happened, but I mean, maybe if it wasn't for the pandemic, I wouldn't have ever connected with you. You know what I mean? Like, there's things like that where I go like, dude, I would not have connected with this person had it not been for this circumstance. And I'm grateful, like, wow, I'm grateful I know this person or know of him or her, you know? So.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of, I think, like the world is constantly changing, right? And so like as a business and someone who is, you know, providing this space for people to do this healing work, there are constant pivots we have to make. How have you continued to maintain that relationship building piece, that accompaniment piece in pandemic times?
We've certainly developed a community, both of our made up with our staff, and then we have a set amount of volunteers that could partake in the assembly of our grocery kits. So that's a 20-person operation, like on Sunday. But you know, leading up to it, there's a lot of work that goes into it, and other folks, either some volunteer, some get paid. But I think that the Sunday giveaways are a good mark of our community, because there's a communal check-in. We do check in with each other. And so there's a big circle, maintaining our social distance, but we do check in outside here at the end of the giveaway and see where people are and how they are.
I saw there was some dancing involved on one of your latest Instagram posts.
That's on the low, though.
Hey, it's out on Instagram.
You know what?
It's for
you
the
know
public
what's crazy
to know.
Is, okay, so like, we'll just make stuff up when there's like a new person involved. We'll say some things like, "Look, there's a little workout that everyone does when they're new." On the spot. You know, and we're in a circle, so we're like, you know, you're gonna have to get in the circle and do like 10 burpees. And so when we're, I don't know, man, there's something about a circle. Like, I don't know if it makes you dance, but we play a little bit of music and some people start moving. And then I think there was one time I was like, you know, for all you newcomers, we do a Soul Train line. And then we didn't even have music, yeah. And I was just telling people, like, clap your hands to the beat, right? And then people just get in the circle and start dancing. So I think it's part of, like, I think it's a big relieving moment for people, especially during this time, because there's an opportunity to share in laughter. And I think, you know, because restorative justice, I wanted to share this with you. There's a thing about stories and restoration. And as serious as we could be here all the time, there's a lot of humor. And I think that's part of the healing. There's the humor in the stories, in moments shared. And I think even in moments that were, you know, that could really be, you know, hurtful moments, I think there's something relieving and sometimes humorous when you start sharing it, you know, like,
right.
So that's how I think restorative justice is still, maybe we're going to have to come up with a restorative justice dance move, you know, but and that's part of it. That's all part of it.
Right. It's so much. And I know you, I think you mentioned this before, but like, it's not just about, you know, repairing the harm. It's about building those connections, building the relationship, so people feel a sense of belonging in that community, right? We know, like, so many people who are impacted by the criminal legal system, right, have done it from a place of disconnection, right? Why do people join gangs? To feel a sense of belonging, right? And then why do they do the things that they do that are harmful to their communities? Because that's what it takes to, quote unquote, belong in that community. If we can give people sense of belonging in another way, right, whether it is through work, whether it is through storytelling, whether it is through dancing, like, that is so much better. And it takes time, it takes effort. I'm curious, like, what's one of the, like, the really hard moments in the work that you've done over the years that, like, really stands out to you?
The harder moments, you know, there's certain things that are not very sexy about urban agriculture. As an, in the beginning, it's like, I was just telling someone we had just hired that I'm heavily involved in having to raise money. I think that's a part of the reality. It's a means to the end of accomplishing what we're doing. So I think those in the beginning, it was very challenging. I think we're sharing the story of what we're doing, how we're hoping to do it. And you have to sell the story, right? That's part of raising money. I think so that, you know, I'm an English major and I did a lot of writing. So I think it helped with that. But I think, the real difficulty there was in the beginning, and it still happens because I still do this, but the shift from having to, you know, I would say, you know, I'm farming during the day and then I'm fundraising at night, you know, I'm having to, you know, work in the daylight digging, and then, you know, I'm on the computer at night. So I think that was early on, those were particular hard stretches, like in terms of the work and seeing that not everyone will be your success story. I think there are particular persons I believed in so much, probably more than they did in themselves at that time. And I think there have been moments that were heartbreaking, where, you know, people either relapse and fall into, you know, the demons of their past addictions. That's been heartbreaking. I think now, like, the daily difficulty is like, you know, unless I'm a robot, will I be able to, like, work all the time here in San Pedro and continue to develop a crew and work alongside them? So I think, like, you know, we're having to develop a staff, and that has its challenges.
I'm curious, like, in those moments of heartbreak or in these moments of struggle, what keeps you going?
I've had this you know, happens maybe sometimes in retreats, or I feel myself loved as a believer. I feel like that's what gets me going to begin with. It's you know, the love I feel comes from God. Now, that being said, the other practical things that keep me going is, you know, I can't be about, like, let's promote healthy food and not have the discipline to eat it. So being smart about eating, you know, trying, really, really making the effort to eat what I talk about. And then so diet is one thing, and then exercise. I've had a hard commitment to, you know, someone described farming as, like, you're picking things up and putting things down all day, which is true. Like, if you think about the motion of planting, shoveling. So, like, yeah, that's kind of it. Praying, eating, and exercising, right? And I'm trying to work on sleeping. I've thought about that, like, trying to, you know, I honestly don't really sleep much, you know. So I've thought about that. It's like, how do you let go at the end of the day? And I think that's one thing I'm working on.
Yeah, like, I'm struggling with this idea of what people call, like, self-care, right? A lot of times, I think there are, like, habits for myself that I need to improve on. Like, you know, COVID closed down the gyms and there went my workout habits, right? But I mean, like, we often frame, you know, self-care around, like, you know, take care of yourself so you can take care of others. One of the things that I've been, that whole, like, you know, put your oxygen mask on before you, like, go help somebody else, right? Or fill up your cup before you pour into others. I've been thinking about, like, how, like, grind culture, like, capitalism, like, just white supremacy culture in general, like, forces us to, like, you know, value ourselves as our productivity. And how do we, like, divorce ourselves from that thinking? That's been tough for me, especially, like, coming up as someone who is, like, an entrepreneur as well, right? Like, when at every moment of the day, I could be doing something that is working on, like, my business or the work that I believe is so impactful, not just for money, but, like, for the impact that it's having, right?
There's a person I follow on Instagram, David Goggins. He's an ultra marathon runner. He's a retired Navy SEAL. And he's essentially his message is hopeful that you know, that with discipline you could do things, right? And then he speaks about his own rough background and how he's managed to navigate through that. But the dude doesn't stop running, right? Even so, I think I'm more inclined to go that route, to see what's possible with crossing a threshold. I think that the thing with the fear of burnout, and this is just I'm just sharing with you what my experience is, man. But like the people who have, you know, whispered in my ear the need to rest, you know, I hear them out. But I think, like, you know, what kind of gets to me is a lot of people talk about burnout when I don't know if they've ever been on fire. Like, this is me, you know, seeing other people who have been designated leaders. Like, I just go, like, I don't know if you've even been on fire, bro. Like, so that's just where I stand. And so I do recognize the need to care for self. But I think there is a subjective reality about that where you will know, like, I will know if I listen to myself well enough, I'll know what it means for me to rest.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I'm curious, with, you know, relationships being like at the center of restorative justice, like tying that into like the relationship with yourself. I think like part of that is knowing yourself and taking care of yourself in the ways that are appropriate for you, right? The ways that you take care of, you know, one set of plants is not the same way that you're going to take care of another set of plants. The way that you're going to care for one person is not the same way that you're going to care for this other person. And like, you know, we're all different and we have different needs. Like, this isn't the, there's not like a Bible that says like, or I guess like a planting guide that says like, this is how all humans need to be cared for. Right.
Right. You know, it's about the, that's another thing about restorative justice. It so honors the developmental stage of the conversation, of the people involved in the conversation. Like, that's the thing with plants. Like, in the beginning, you may have to water heavily. And I'll tell you now, like, this is what I learned, and this is a planting tip. So once okra is established, like, I couldn't figure out why it wasn't fruiting as much as I was hoping. What we had to do was cut the water off completely, because it's established and now it's fruiting. There's been no water for like a month, you know? So I think in terms of like, you know, how to care for things, there's different stages of development. And I think that's one thing that I will take from like a framework of restorative justice is it really poses and honors, it poses the question if you're ready to engage in this, but it honors your readiness. And it honors also if you're not ready. It honors if you're ready at one point, and if you need more time, fine. But that's kind of like the framework where it's like, you know, I do think it just makes room, you know, it just makes space.
Say more.
Yeah, I think, man, maybe if I was to ever give you a little walking tour through here, You may pick up the elements of how even in the design and layout of the farm, it tends to have restorative elements, like climate appropriate plants so that you could restore habitat for native bugs and birds and bees, you know, to thrive. So there's even the restoration there taking place, and you know, like even in regards to it being a larger framework, there is the restoration of relationship between the land and the people that inhabit it. There's also that element. So I've been aware of how we've approached, you know, our design and how we farm with a bit of a restorative lens.
Yeah, like can you share some more of those things? Go ahead.
Yeah. So like our growing is soil based, right?
Okay. As opposed to
like aquaponics where you're just growing.
Okay.
And so like, you know, you'll often hear organic growers, you know, like if you're putting synthetic fertilizers and synthetic this and that, you're harming the soil. You're hurting it. You're hurting all the life, all the microbial life, right? And so like the organic way is to you know, with organic amendments, you know, we use chicken manure. We use materials like compost that's transformed waste matter into nutrients for the soil. So there's that restoration, and even composting is restorative, where you take what would otherwise be considered, you know, waste, and you transform that into something so necessary to the well-being of all the microbial life that will eventually essentially help the plants grow. I once heard a farmer say this, and I was tripping when he said this, but he said on a vineyard, he said he knew how every plant, and it was a smaller vineyard, it was a Zinfandel wine grape, Zinfandel grapes for Zinfandel wine, right? And he was like, I know how every, he does dry farming. So I was new to all this, and I was like, I don't know, that sounds a little crazy. But he relied on the coastal air and moisture to provide the irrigation for his vineyard. But he said he knew how every plant behaved. And I tripped out on that, but that just signified how he had a relationship with every vine. And I can't say I have. There are hundreds of plants here, if not maybe a thousand small plants, you know. But that's one restorative way. It's even with the soil, you know. It starts from the ground, you know.
That's cool. I have like this set of questions that are meant to be rapid fire, but I often end up asking follow-up questions. So we're just going to let that go where it goes. Define restorative justice.
Restorative justice for me means that there's explicit recognition that straddles some level of celebration of our interdependence with each other. My well-being, my healing, my capacity to do well personally is totally interdependent with others.
Are you familiar with the term kapwa?
No.
So in Tagalog, and I know your family's Ilocano, but in Tagalog, it's this idea of togetherness. But in Babayan, which is a pre-colonial language of the Philippines, it's like this interconnection between all beings, right? Similar to Ubuntu, right? Or in Lakech, which is a Mayan phrase, like I am another you are another me, or Lakota phrase, Mitakuyas, and we are all relatives, right? I've really appreciated my friend Christiane, she's also she's Filipina. She shared that with me. And it's something that I've really appreciated passing on to other Filipinos who, you know, we have this within our own culture. Like it's something that is within us and, you know, everybody else. But, you know, within the context of this conversation, you know, our ancestors knew this and lived this.
I would even go so far as to say, like, and I bring this up often. it's one of our where we tend to reflect or meditate, this interdependence goes beyond the dimension of this material world. There's still an interdependence because our ancestors are very alive and well in another dimension. And I think, you know, restorative justice, it goes beyond just the here and now. And I've said this to myself during this pandemic, you know, because like people are referring to the pandemic of 19 or 1918. And so in a way, there's a question that's posed, like, is this, you know, how did our ancestors navigate through this? And, you know, like, I tell myself, man, like, our ancestors have navigated through a lot, probably a lot more than this, you know? And they wouldn't necessarily be running to Costco for toilet paper because we have tables, you know? Filipinos don't, right? But I was gonna say like that, like that's I'm being funny, but in regard to like restorative work and restorative justice, the togetherness you mentioned, I do think it's there's an interdependence, but it goes beyond these dimensions. It goes beyond these dimensions. Yeah.
How do you tap into that?
So. My grandfather, for instance, was a carpenter, and I only hear stories because he died when I was 3 years old. But he used to walk me and my sister to the local 7-Eleven to buy us
Slurpees. Pop. Oh, okay.
Big pops. There's a lot of carpentry involved in what we do, but I find myself talking to him when I do it. I know it might sound crazy, but I thank him. I thank him for his carpentry skills and sharing it with me. Because I'm not saying I'm very, very good, but I could get down with you know, like, but I wonder, like, where did I pick this up? I did learn from a very, very skilled deck builder. But I find myself asking, you know, like there are certain problems when you come across either fastening certain things. And then part of how I approach trying to resolve those problems is that I'll just pose it to like my grandpa. And as a believer, as a Catholic, I believe that Saint Joseph was a carpenter. I'd even put it out there in the atmosphere, like how would we do this? How do we go about doing this? And I think there's guidance where I probably wouldn't be able to articulate exactly how, but I think I'm putting it into the universe, asking those who've gone before me how to do this.
Yeah, for sure. What is one place or situation where you wish people really knew restorative justice work?
I was going to say schools because of the amount of time young children have in schools, but I would say in families, especially with young children, because I think it starts there where... you know, I think it's in families with children because I think it's like the easy way to already establish a punitive culture there. You're doing this wrong, you're gonna get this, you know. So you're already establishing this kind of consequence, which is all good in its way. It has its place there. I think in the space of you know, families and children, that's why I think I'd want, you know, for it to start.
Yeah, so from when this airs, I think, 3 episodes back. But the conversation for our purposes that I had a couple weeks ago with Ruben, his nickname is RJ, but it's confusing when we're talking about restorative justice. Ruben, we were talking about how his Caribbean parents, he grew up, he was born in the UK from people from the Caribbean and then grew up in New York. And, you know, in households with people of color who have often been colonized, they've learned their parenting styles from colonizers who either enslaved our people or punitive in ways of like trying to control. And those are the methods that have been passed down. And so, you know, we make jokes about, you know, getting a palo or getting the chancla in communities of colors or getting whoopings. But like, those aren't our ancestral ways. Like, those were taught to us by like colonizers, right?
It would also shed light on this. This is the other thing that would shed light on if restorative justice and its practice started in households. We would probably be more inclined to be aware of developmental stages of growth, that this kid's just being a kid, really. So what would be considered criminal is just really, or not criminal, but like bad behavior. It's just that this kid so happens to be very excitable with it. It really requires you to pay close attention. That's the thing, you know. And I think if that was where it starts, you're really paying close attention to, you know, subjective realities and so, you know, like, if it doesn't start in the household, I think my next place would be in schools, you know.
Yeah, for the children, absolutely. You get to sit in circle with 4 other people. Who are they and what do they talk about?
If it's for the sake of hearing them talk, or...
It's to be in conversation. Rephrase. It's a play on the dinner part. Like, you get to invite 4 people to dinner, right? But like, because it's restorative justice, we're talking in circles. So you get to sit in circle with 4 people. Who are they? It could be living or dead. Who are they? What do you talk about?
Living. Okay, I mentioned David Goggins because I'm actually interested in his understanding of suffering. I would want to pick his brain on that. He writes about it, and so I'd want to pick his brain on that. You know, like, and I don't want to sound like corny, but Gandhi, you know, I'd want to talk to the movement makers where, all right, so I have David Goggins, I'd say Gandhi. I'd say Martin Luther King, and I'd say Jesus.
I think that puts David Goggins in some crazy company, but yeah.
You know, it does, but the thing that may be shared amongst the 4, right? I'm just thinking about it. Is they're willing to put life and limb for what they believe in. They're willing to just lay it all down. I mean, I'd add Michael Jackson to that. Like, it depends on what the conversation is, but if it's restorative justice, like, you know.
Oh, I mean, it's not necessarily a conversation about restorative justice, just like, you know, people you want to have a conversation with, but like, you know, laying down life and limb, like being so driven to one thing, dedicated towards one thing. Yeah.
I mean, I guess there's a lot of people I want to talk to, but I guess they've come to mind maybe in part because I've paid attention.
What's one thing you want everyone listening to this podcast to know?
I would want people to feel that just as they are, they're so dearly loved by someone. It doesn't matter, you know, their past doesn't matter, the future doesn't matter, just in the now. They're so deeply, dearly loved. I think that's sometimes hard to recognize, but I believe that to be truth. That's really it.
for sure. And finally, how and where can people support your work?
It may be as simple as like just doing better for yourself and for the people around you. That like is kind of a wide general thing. But I think if you want to follow us and just know of our work, we're active on Instagram at Alma Backyard Farms. We have a website, almabackyardfarms.com. We welcome prayers and we welcome donations to keep us going. That's welcome. I think, this sounds funny, but I think we could all help each other in the world if we just took a deeper breath. So like, sometimes I pray for that, like that we all take a collective deep breath. And I know that's something too that happens in restorative. I was exposed to a lot of this through like the restorative justice work,
breathing, supporting, taking care, start a garden. Thank you so much for your time. This is not the last time that we'll talk. We're actually going to continue this conversation after I stop this recording. But thank you so much for sharing your story, your wisdom. We'll link everything that you shared in the description. And thank you so much for being on this podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me, man. I'm honored and grateful. And, moments like this kind of give me an opportunity to remember why I do what I do to begin with. So thanks for that opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you all for listening. Take care, and we'll talk to you next week. Like what you heard? Please subscribe, rate, review, and share this podcast on whatever platform you're using right now. It really helps us further amplify this work. You can also support us by following us on our social platforms, signing up for our email list, rocking our new merch, joining our Patreon, or signing up for a workshop. So many options! Links to everything in the show notes and on our website, amplifyrj.com. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you next week.